happy birthday today to Lester Haas of Harlan. And Lester, you are joined today on your birthday by Gene Shalit, film critic, and who turned 98 years old today. Singer Anita Bryant turns 84 today. Singer Elton John turns 77. And actor Sarah Jessica Parker turns 59 today. So a happy birthday to Lester and to all the folks who turned a new year today. Happy birthday to you all. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who's listening in order to keep our services free. And now with today's obituary, here's Nicole.
Today we'd like to remember Edward Huntoon. Edward Leroy Huntoon, 85 years old, of Indianola, Iowa, passed away on Friday, March 22nd in Des Moines. Memorial services will be at 10:30 in the morning on Friday, March 29th, over at the Overton Funeral Home in Indianola. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to service. That's from 9:30 to 10:30 at the funeral home. Interment will be held at a later date over in the Highland Memorial Garden Cemetery. Edward is survived by his wife, Nathena Nikki, and also children David, Sherry, Eric, and stepchildren Christine, Brenda, Anthony, and also 16 grandchildren and 13 great-grandchildren, his brother Steve, and two nieces. He was preceded in death by his parents, Roy and Florence Huntoon. Memorials in his name may be given to DMARC, 100 Army Post Road in Des Moines, 50315, for the food pantries. You can also sign an online condolence by visiting the website at www.overtonfunerals.com. Now here is Twyla with the next story.
And we'll return now to some national news contained in the front page section of the Register. Christie will not rule out a third-party presidential run. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is no longer ruling out a third-party presidential bid with the centrist group No Labels. Christie said he would do whatever he could to make sure the country does not go through what he called the misery of a second Trump term during an appearance on the podcast The Axe Files, hosted by former President Barack Obama's advisor David Axelrod. I wouldn't preclude anything at this point, David, said Christie in response to a direct question about whether he was considering a run. I would just say that there are a number of hurdles to get over before I'd actually consider running as a third party, he said. No Labels, a bipartisan nonprofit organization, is searching for candidates to appear on a potential unity ticket in the November election. A number of high-profile officials have been tied to the group, including former Maryland GOP Governor Larry Hogan and Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat of West Virginia. But many have ruled out running for the group's presidential push. One of the main concerns is that the group could act as a spoiler in the November general election and split the vote between President Joe Biden, who is 81, and former President Donald Trump, who is 77, the presumptive nominees. The centrist think tank Third Way has criticized No Labels, arguing that its third-party run could hand the 2024 election to Trump. But Christie, who is one of Trump's most vocal Republican critics, pushed back against those concerns. I don't think you can game that out 7 months before an election, he told Axelrod. Christie argued that Biden's age and Trump's sweeping legal charges already made the 2024 election unprecedented. Do I think it's likely a third-party candidate could be elected president? No, I don't think it's likely, he said. Do I think it's possible? In this environment, anything is possible, he said. Christie, a former prosecutor, decided to suspend his campaign for the Republican nomination in early January after finding that he did not have a feasible path to the nomination. His openness to the possibility of a third-party run is a sharp departure from previous comments that he's made about the option. Shortly before he dropped out of the GOP primary, Christie outright rejected a No Labels run.
Tribes seek funds to help deal with crime. Reservations in U.S. lack resources to secure land. Tribal nations need more money from Congress to keep people safe, their leaders told federal lawmakers. Officials representing tribes in Oklahoma and 14 other states said on March 20th that inadequate funding has hamstrung their criminal justice system, leaving them unable to fully address the opioid crisis. Many leaders also called on Congress to restore the power of tribal courts over all people suspected of dealing drugs and committing other crimes on reservations, not just those who are Native. This is a little bit of a tricky name here, but Genevieve Chaudhary, it's an ambassador and citizen of the Muscogee Nation in eastern Oklahoma, says there's a commonality with all of these problems, and the commonality is that tribal nations have been handcuffed in their ability to protect their own. Chaudhary and other tribal officials spoke at a listening session held by Senate Indian Affairs Committee. Senator Brian Schatz, a Hawaii Democrat who chairs that committee, said the hearing about the most pressing public safety issues facing tribal nations would help lawmakers prioritize their next steps. Senator John Tester, a Democrat from Montana, acknowledged that no single fix would solve the crisis that many tribal communities face. Tribal and federal law enforcement agencies need more resources across the board to start solving the problems, according to Tester. The discussion on Capitol Hill landed as several tribal nations in Oklahoma worked to expand their criminal justice systems across their reservations after regaining legal recognition in the past 4 years. Charles Addington, who leads the Quanpah Nation Marshal Service in the northeast part of that state, said that federal funding often stays at the federal level within agencies like the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which has its own law enforcement arm, rather than reaching tribal nations directly. Addington, a Cherokee Nation citizen, says, in order to make a difference, you've got to make sure you're being partners with these tribal law enforcement programs. The current system creates a checkboard approach to addressing crime and enforcing the law, Chaudhary says. He said the solution is empowering local governments on the ground. That's always been the resolution, or solution rather. He joined more than a dozen other tribal leaders in asking for Congress to pass a law that would expand the power of tribal courts over non-Native defendants. The Supreme Court ruled in 1978 that tribal courts do not have inherent criminal jurisdiction over people who aren't Native American, and that only Congress can assign that jurisdiction. Lawmakers have done so as recently as 2022, when they extended the jurisdiction of tribal courts to cover anyone accused of sexually abusing, trafficking, or stalking a Native person, as well as some other related crimes. Congress should extend that list to cover all crimes on tribal lands, according to Mark Macaro. That's the chairman of the chairman of the Pechanga Band of Laceno Indians in California, and also the president of National Congress of American Indians. He said Indian country is in acute crisis right now and has been for decades, actually. Crisis in law enforcement, crisis in public safety, crisis in injustice. One of the fundamental solutions is the restoration of our own sovereign governments to protect our citizens in their own homes and our lands.
College age process hits another snag. The U.S. Department of Education acknowledges Friday that it has sent hundreds of thousands of inaccurate student financial aid assessments to colleges in recent weeks, an error it blamed on an outside vendor. Although the announcement said the problem has been resolved, it likely will further delay financial aid offers to college and high school students. Critics described the oversight as the latest misstep in the Biden administration's rollout of the new Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or FAFSA, a college financial aid form used by millions of students every year. A congressional mandate to streamline the form has been beset with glitches and blunders, eroding trust between colleges and the federal officials they rely on to help them dole out financial aid to students. Problems with outside contractors have dogged the rollout of the new form from the start. The federal government secured a multi-million dollar contract in 2022 with the company General Dynamics Information Technology to modernize the Education Department's aid processing systems. General Dynamics was also involved in the launch of the Affordable Care Act. The department did not specifically identify which vendor it was blaming, and in such large projects, multiple vendors and subcontractors are often involved. General Dynamics, in particular, has been a sore subject in the Education Department in recent months, as some officials in the office that oversees the FAFSA have complained that the vendor is not getting enough of the blame for some of the glitches. Now, many colleges are once again left waiting on the federal government as they scramble to pack what is usually months' worth of work into a matter of weeks. While many institutions have their own forms of financial aid, they start with a foundation from the federal government. They depend on the Education Department to collect applicants' financial information. In a statement Friday, Justin Draeger, president of the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, underscored that colleges and universities can only work with valid and correct data provided to them by the government. This is another unforced error that will likely cause more processing delays for students, Draeger said. At this stage in the game and after so many delays, every error adds up and will be felt acutely by every student who is counting on need-based financial aid to make their post-secondary dreams a reality, he said. The Education Department miscalculated the amount of money that roughly 200,000 students could afford to pay for college, potentially giving more financial aid to students with more money. The agency's formula for crunching those numbers requires officials to include how much students who depend on their parents' income also have in their own savings and checking accounts. The net worth of any other investments or cash the student has is supposed to be part of that calculation as well. But it was not, at least until Thursday, when the department stopped sending out incorrect data. In the statement to USA Today, an Education Department spokesman confirmed the oversight as a vendor issue that will not affect any future records. We remain focused on helping students and families through this process and supporting colleges to produce aid offers as quickly as possible, the spokesperson said. The hundreds of thousands of erroneous calculations are now being reprocessed, according to the agency.
Video shows first Neuralink patient playing online chess. The first patient to get a cybernetic implant from Elon Musk's Neuralink company appeared to move a cursor using his brain to play online chess in a video that's released by the company. In a live stream video on X, formerly known as Twitter, on Wednesday, Nolan Arbaugh moves the cursor on a computer without using any physical tools. Arbaugh, who's 29, said that he used his mind to play the online chess game. He says it was like using the force. Arbaugh was paralyzed from the shoulders down after a freak diving accident 8 years ago, he said in the video. He loved playing chess, he says, but it hasn't been something that he was able to do often over the past few years. He explained, "Now it's all being done with my brain. You can see the cursor moving around the screen. That is all me." Arbaugh, an Arizona native, was a student and athlete over at Texas A&M when he became paralyzed, according to a GoFundMe that was set up back in 2017 to help get him a handicapped access van. According to the fundraiser, Arbaugh was working as a summer camp counselor for children when he then got into the accident that led him quadriplic in 2016. He said in the live stream, "I'm paralyzed from below the shoulders. I have no sensation or movement below my level of injury, so below my shoulders." An avid gamer, Alba says that Neuralink gave him the ability to play games again, including Civilization VI, which he played for 8 years straight. He said, "I had basically given up on playing that game. I just wasn't really able to play it as much as I wanted to, and he gave me that ability again." Arbaugh is the first person to use this new technology. Back in January, Musk announced the first human to receive the brain chip was recovering well. During the live stream on Wednesday, Arbaugh says that he had no issues following his surgery. "The surgery was super easy. I was released from the hospital a day later, and I have no cognitive impairments." However, Arba says the technology is not perfect and they have run into some issues. He says, I don't want people to think that this is the end of a journey because there are things to work out, but it's already changed my life. The goal of Neuralink's brain-computer interface, or BCI, is to allow for paralyzed people to control a computer or mobile device wirelessly just by thinking about it, according to the company's website. Musk said in a post on X, imagine if Stephen Hawking could communicate faster than a speed typist or auctioneer. That is the goal. In May, the tech startup owned and co-founded by Musk announced that it received approval from the Food and Drug Administration to implant brain chips into humans. The company announced in September that it received approval to recruit one of the first in-human clinical trials for this new technology. Musk said the product is called Telepathy. Neuralink's NI implant actually includes multiple chips, a wireless battery, and other electronics, hermetically sealed within a device about the size of a large coin. The process involves surgically placing the implant into a region of the brain that controls movement indentation. A surgical robot was created specifically to embed the N1 implant and its 64 ultra-thin flexible connected threads, upon which are 1,024 electrodes that record neural activity. The robot uses a needle as thin as a human hair, Neuralink site says. It has 5 built-in camera systems and it also uses optical coherence tomography for non-invasive imaging of the brain tissue. Signals from the implant are sent via a Bluetooth to and decoded by a brain-computer interface, which would allow for a person, for instance, to control an on-screen cursor or move a robotic limb.
Wow. Some cancers are afflicting younger adults. Princess Kate's cancer diagnosis at the age of 42 shines a light on a dreaded disease that seems to be striking people at younger ages, though it has become more survivable. Americans have about a 40% chance of developing cancer at some point in their lives. Just under 20% who develop it die from cancer, which is the second leading cause of death in the United States. It is typically considered a disease of aging, with 88% of diagnoses coming in people age 50 or older, according to the American Cancer Society. But colon cancer is increasing in younger people, according to the National Cancer Institute. Americans born between 1981 and 1996 are at twice the risk for colon cancer as those born in 1950. Other cancers have also increased in younger adults, though it is not clear why. After a diagnosis, people often try to look back to understand how and why they might have gotten sick and what they might have done wrong, said Dr. Ginger Gardner, a gynecologic surgeon at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Often, they did nothing at all. Cancer does not always play by the rules, she told USA Today. The good news is that many types of cancer are now survivable for years, if not decades. The quality of life for survivors has improved markedly, and there are ways to improve the odds. Whenever cancer happens, and certainly in a young population, it really does underscore the importance of several key teachable moments or moments of awareness, Gardner said. The first, she said, is to be aware of your body. If something feels different, be proactive and get it checked out, she said. That might mean a change in bowel movements, pelvic pressure or discomfort, bloating or rectal bleeding, said Dr. Richard Barakat, physician in chief and executive director of the Northwell Health Cancer Institute, which operates 21 hospitals and 10 cancer centers in New York. Screening also offers an opportunity to catch certain cancers early when the odds of survival are better and the treatments typically less harsh. Federal guidelines suggest people start routine screening for cervical cancer at age 21, colon cancer at 45, breast cancer no later than 45 with an option to start at 40, lung cancer at 50 for smokers, and prostate cancer at 55 for people at average risk for the disease, while those at higher risk should start earlier. The HPV vaccine can dramatically reduce the risk of several cancers, including cancer of the cervix, penis, and anus. Genetics and family history can also be useful, as more treatments and screens are now tied to specific patterns of genetics, Gardner said. Some genes, such as the BRCA1 and BRCA2, are associated with specific cancers like breast and ovarian, leading some people to get preventative surgeries. While some genetic conditions, including one called Lynch syndrome, can increase the risk for a wide range of cancers. Gardner is particularly passionate about gynecologic cancers. Someone is diagnosed every 5 minutes in the U.S., and research into them is woefully underfunded, she said. There are 5 cancer types considered gynecologic: cervical, ovarian, uterine, vaginal, and vulvar. We are in a very exciting time of research and understanding the biology of these diseases better, Gardner said. Women's cancers need more attention. Cancer strikes about 1.6 million Americans a year and kills more than 600,000. The American Cancer Society projects 611,720 people will die from some form of cancer in 2024. That number is slightly higher than a year ago, but much lower than in 1991. The rate of people who die from cancer dropped 33% from 1991 through 2021, according to the organization's most recent statistics. The latest data from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention shows 1,603,844 new cancer cases were reported and 602,347 people died of cancer in the United States in 2020. Just over 400 new cancers were reported and 144 cancer-related deaths for every 100,000 people, according to the latest data available from the CDC. The most common types of cancer include breast, lung, prostate, colon, rectal, and a type of skin cancer called melanoma, according to the National Cancer Institute. Men are most likely to have prostate, lung, and colorectal cancers, and women are most likely to have breast, lung, and colorectal cancers. Lifestyle activities help reduce cancer risk, including limiting tobacco and alcohol, eating a healthy diet without too many heavily processed foods, and avoiding as much sun exposure, according to the CDC. It's not clear why some cancers are increasing among younger people, Barakat said. Factors that have been considered include the environment, changes in the gut microbiome, and obesity. It's quite worrisome, he said.
All right, and we're going to continue on with the 50 states. I'll finish up the Midwest states, and then Twyla can carry on with whatever. Okay, so the next Midwest state is over in Indiana, out of Indianapolis. The Indiana University Melvin and Bren Simon Comprehensive Cancer Center will be expanding its lung cancer research efforts after receiving a gift of $20 million from the family of a well-known Indianapolis auto executive who died of the disease. Topeka, Kansas, a bill creating what's among the most limited medical marijuana programs in the country, was introduced in the Kansas State House after years of failed attempts in creating a program. Out of Delta Township, Michigan, McLaurin Greater Lansing will start building a $40 million freestanding emergency department and medical office building near Grand Ledge this summer. The 33,680-square-foot facility is expected to include a 17-room emergency department and a family medicine office where up to 5 primary care providers will see patients. St. Cloud, Minnesota. St. Cloud might have a solution to help its growing homeless population. The City Council is hosting a public hearing on Monday regarding the proposed Avivo Village homeless shelter site. Out of Springfield, Missouri, the most recent designs for Springfield Art Museum's renovation have now doubled the scope of the project, which aims to transform the museum into a modern civic asset and a third place for the community. With the larger scope, the cost of the project has also increased twofold, leaving the future of the first phase of construction uncertain. Lincoln, Nebraska. To win the presidency, the candidate must secure at least 270 electoral votes, and all eyes are on the Cornhusker State's 2nd Congressional District, which holds a single electoral vote that could potentially determine the outcome of the election. In 2020, President Joe Biden won Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District, also known as the Blue Dot, and it includes Omaha, the biggest city in the state. Democrats are now focused on winning this district once again while facing challenges in rebuilding support in the blue wall states that helped Biden win 4 years ago. Bismarck, North Dakota. North Dakota's Department of Transportation officials are looking to replace two state-owned airplanes with newer and safer models. In Norwood, Ohio, Health Carousel, it's a Norwood-based travel, nursing, and staffing firm, has agreed to settle a $6 million class action lawsuit that's brought on by former employees who had accused it of fraud and also violating labor trafficking laws. Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. As Southern Baptists across the country grapple with allegations of sexual abuse dating back decades, leaders of a Oklahoma church are now looking into the case of a former minister who was accused of abusing a teenager in 2006. And the final Midwest city I have here is Sioux Falls, South Dakota. A group of It's a university in South Dakota. I believe it's pronounced Augustana University. They gathered in solidarity, sitting in a circle and chanting prayers from their respective religions, one after another, to commemorate the official reopening of the Interfaith Room. The opening of the Interfaith Room took place on February 28th. It was intended to be a renewal of sorts. It was a marked movement of healing from a traumatic moment in January of 2023 when the sacred space was taken away by the administration without the council's consent or knowledge.
And that sort of gets us into the states surrounding Iowa. So now we'll take a look at some of these states a little farther away from Iowa. Let's begin with Alabama. Tuscaloosa, the University of Alabama added almost $2.948 billion, that would be $2.948 million, to the state economy during the 2020 and 21 academic year, according to a study for the Center for Business and Economic Research in the UA Culverhouse College of Business. From Anchorage, Alaska, a National Weather Service climate researcher said despite setting several snowfall records this winter, it does not look likely that the city will break its all-time record of total snowfall, according to Alaska Public Media. From Phoenix, Arizona, the Arizona Department of Public Safety failed to meet several federal grant administration requirements in its distribution of over $160 million to victim services, according to a report released by the U.S. Department of Justice Office of the Inspector General. From Fort Smith, Arkansas, money is flowing in for potential Arkansas ballot measures. Language for several of the major measures, including ones concerning abortion and the Freedom of Information Act, were approved January, and signature gathering efforts are underway. Another concerning public education was approved just this last month. From Palm Springs, California, the owners of the Coachella, Valley Music and Arts Festival are suing Coachella Valley Brewing Company, alleging the beer maker is breaking federal trademark laws by using logos and advertising that look that are like those of the festival itself. From Pueblo, Colorado, Pueblo school district administrators and members of law enforcement recently advised parents of fourth grade students at Highland Park Elementary School to make sure their children did not bring home fentanyl after more than 60 pills were discovered on a bus used to take the students on a field trip to the Denver Aquarium, that according to Pueblo police. In Killingly, Connecticut, the town of Killingly has decided not to leave the Northeast District Department of Health. I hope they have something backing that up. In Rehoboth, Delaware, Rehoboth Beach commissioners are raising taxes and fees across the board to cover an over $4 million budget deficit this year. From the From the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., authorities are investigating after a man was killed in a shooting in southeast D.C., according to WUSA 9. That's a television station in Washington, D.C. And from West Palm Beach, Florida, a swell of affluence in South Florida kept West Palm Beach and Palm Beach in the top five list of the fastest growing cities nationwide for accumulating millionaire residents over the past decade, according to a wealth tracking report released this month. The two Palm Beach County cities experienced a 93% increase in millionaires between 2013 and 2023, ranking it third in this year's Henley & Partners USA Wealth Report. And finally, from Tybee Island, Georgia, a controversial Tybee Island short-term rental ordinance will have a public hearing at Tybee Island's Planning Commission on April 15, the next step before it reaches Tybee Island City Council for a vote. And that wraps up the time for we have for reports from 50-state roundup from USA Today. And for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Nicole Tam and me, Twyla Glenn. It has been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers for the next half hour are Jeff Cassett and Carol Lockard. Here's Carol with the opinion section. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And our first article today is Believe Hamas Hostages on Sexual Violence. It's by Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who is a Democrat representative representing Florida's 25th Congressional District. Here's what she has to say. I traveled to Israel just 3 days after the October 7th massacre. I was already in the region as part of a bipartisan, bicameral congressional delegation to advance peace negotiations when Hamas terrorists attacked. The brutality and destruction I saw on that visit still haunts me. The massacre had shaken every Israeli, leaving them afraid and uncertain in their own homes. Everyone was mourning the 1,200 lives lost and the hundreds more taken into Gaza as hostages. Others were trapped in a torturous limbo with loved ones kidnapped to the other side of the Gaza border. For so many Israelis and Jews, the trauma of October 7th is still unfolding. As videos and stories started circulating, the world began to see the extent of Hamas's brutality, including the weaponization of horrific sexual violence against Israeli women. After surviving unthinkable violence, many women have bravely shared their stories with the world. They decided to shine a light on their horrific experiences so that others will know they are not alone. But instead of applause for their courage and bravery, they faced scrutiny, threats, and dismissal. What a United Nations report confirms about sexual violence. In the past several years, we've made incredible progress in listening to women and treating them as experts in their own experiences. But I am devastated that the harrowing stories I heard firsthand from survivors in Israel were being disbelieved and denied. Voices on social and traditional media, some with substantial platforms, have denied or even justified Hamas's crimes since the beginning, a conspiracy that has now infected our mainstream discourse. For Jews, the violent reports of the massacre echoed so many of the stories we had all grown up hearing from our grandmothers and grandfathers. Stories about Jews being forced from their homes, separated from their families, and killed for their faith. But then, as is happening now, when we look around for allies, we often find ourselves standing alone. Despite overwhelming evidence of Hamas's use of sexual and gender-based violence as a weapon of war on and since October 7th, including a recent and long overdue report from the United Nations finding evidence of sexual abuse at the Nova Music Festival, Road 232, and Kibbutz Rim, survivors have been ignored and belittled. The UN report confirms what survivors and experts have been saying for months, including the devastating reality that most victims of sexual violence on October 7th were murdered. Those victims were never given the opportunity to speak out, leaving a few survivors with the burden and trauma of all their untold stories. Refusal to acknowledge the truth of their stories and the irrefutable evidence of their horrific experiences ensures that violence inflicted on women will continue unabated. We cannot tell the 1 in 3 women across the world who have suffered physical or sexual violence. Don't speak up. No one will believe you. Women in Israel and in every corner of our world deserve better. That's why I recently held a forum bringing together Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff, Israeli Ambassador Michael Herzog, Special Envoy Deborah Lipstadt, women members of Congress, Jewish women, civil society leaders, and Israeli law enforcement to call attention to Hamas's use of sexual and gender-based violence. As the first Jewish congresswoman from Florida, and as a fierce defender of women's rights, I am called, both by the constituents I represent and by my faith, to not stand idly by when injustice happens right before our eyes. I try to make good on this obligation every day in Congress, in part by holding my colleagues to that same standard. We must speak out against Hamas's use of rape as a weapon. We will not allow skeptics to silence us. We will not allow anti-Semites to commandeer our conversation, place our trauma in so-called proper context, or decide which stories are worth telling and believing. Hamas used rape as a weapon of war on October 7th and continues to violate hostages in captivity. These are facts. Now we as a country have to decide what we will do about it. My colleagues in the House and I have taken a crucial first step by passing a resolution condemning these acts of violence and demanding that all international bodies condemn sexual and gender-based attacks as a weapon of war, including when committed against Jews. While I am proud there is a consensus in opposition to Hamas's unthinkable crimes, I am shocked that so many others refuse to recognize the humanity of Hamas's victims. We must continue to fight to bring the remaining hostages home. Today, 134 of those hostages remain in Hamas captivity. 134 friends and family members who have missed countless milestones and moments while separated from their loved ones. 8 are U.S. citizens. I am grateful for all the work President Joe Biden has done to fight for their safe return, especially as nightmarish testimony is shared by survivors. The fact that those still held in Gaza face the same sexual violence only escalates the urgency of securing their freedom. There is no time to waste. Every day the hostages remain captive is dangerous. And when they come home, if they decide to tell their stories, we need to believe them. And here's Jeff Cassett.
My family once owned slaves. I owe it to my son to own up. This opinion piece by Eric Rucker, actually the Reverend Eric Rucker, who's an ordained minister in the Episcopal Church. He pastors at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church in Des Moines, and this column originally appeared in the Des Moines Register. My two-year-old son is beginning to ask all kinds of questions, and I've begun to wonder what I will share with him about his family's heritage. As I've considered this, I've realized how little I know about my family's story. I grew up with the implicit knowledge that I'm white, but white is not an ethnic group. Ta-Nehisi Coates observes that I am from the people who believe themselves to be white. This phrase uncovers the truth that white is an idea created by people in power to maintain dominance. Thus, who qualifies as white is continually shifting. As I cut through the facade of generic whiteness to learn about my history, I discovered that my ancestors arrived on this continent in 1690 and founded Rutgersville, Virginia. I also found evidence that we owned enslaved African people. A few years ago, the Iowa legislature passed a bill restricting public schools from teaching concepts that might make students, quote, feel discomfort or guilt on account of race or sex, end quote. Based on this criterion, teaching my son that his ancestors enslaved African people and that this enslavement has economic ramifications today would be illegal in his classroom. Is this really how we want to raise our children, sheltering them from historical complexity and implying that they don't have the strength to reckon with their people's past? When we avoid racial history, white political leaders end up taking positions that are hypocritical. Governor Kim Reynolds rails about protecting the southern border from undocumented immigrants. But the truth is that with the exception of indigenous Americans, all our families are immigrants to America, including Reynolds. There's a Christian framework to learn and grow and heal. I'm a Christian pastor. In our religion, we're given a roadmap for how to work with our community's transgressions. It's called repentance. And it's what Jesus called everyone to, especially those who wield racial or political power. The first step in repentance is telling the truth. The second step is confessing our sin. And the third is repairing the harm. Quote Luke 19, verses 1 to 10. The irony is that often Iowa leaders who oppose teaching racial history are Christian themselves. But these leaders are unaware that the Jesus whom they call Savior demands his followers repent through confession and wrestling honestly with how to repair past harms. Instead of doing the work of repentance, most Republican politicians are legislating devotion to the United States' exceptional and praiseworthy history. Anything less than honesty is a disservice to my son. I'm going to tell my son about our whole family history. I'm going to teach him that he can be grateful for the sacrifices of his forebears while also having the courage to reckon with our crimes against African and indigenous people. I'm going to help him understand how he still benefits from advantages that were gained because of racism, past and present. And I'm going to show him how his faith calls him to a process of love and repentance to correct racial injustices. Anything less than this honesty is a disservice to my son and to our whole community. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And that concludes our opinions, so we'll go to the sports pages. And start with sports on TV for Monday, March 25th. And these times are all current for Central Time. College women's basketball at 1 p.m. today on ESPN2, NCAA tournament, Mississippi versus Notre Dame, second round. At 3 p.m., ESPN NCAA Tournament, Tennessee versus North Carolina State, second round. And at 5 p.m., ESPN NCAA Tournament, Syracuse versus UConn, second round. 5:30 ESPN2 NCAA Tournament, Oklahoma versus Indiana, second round. And then at 7 p.m., ESPN NCAA Tournament, West Virginia versus Iowa, second round. You may be interested in that one. That's at 7 p.m. 10 p.m., ESPN NCAA Tournament, Kansas versus Southern Cal, second round. 9:30, ESPN2 NCAA Tournament, Utah versus Gonzaga, second round. And for women's college lacrosse, at 3:30 today, 3:30 p.m., ESPNU Northwestern at North Carolina. College softball at 6 p.m. on SECN, Tennessee at South Carolina. MLB baseball at noon today, MLBN spring training, New York Mets versus New York Yankees, Tampa, Florida. At 3 p.m., MLBN spring training, St. Louis versus Chicago Cubs in Mesa, Arizona. 7 p.m., MLBN spring training, Boston at Texas. For NBA basketball at 6:30 p.m. this evening, NBA TV, Boston at Atlanta, and Brooklyn at Toronto. 9 p.m. tonight, NBA TV, Philadelphia at Sacramento. For NHL hockey at 7 p.m. tonight, NHLN, Vegas at St. Louis. Men's soccer at 10:50. Oh, that was this morning. It's past. I guess not. 10:50. That starts in just a few minutes. FS2, International Friendly. Azerbaijani versus Bulgaria, Baku, Azerbaijani. At Azerbaijani. And at 12:50 p.m., that's the right afternoon, FS2, International Friendly, Sweden versus Albania at Solna, Sweden. And our final is for tennis at 10 a.m. on the Tennis Channel, Miami WTA round of 16, Miami ATP early rounds. Jeff, back to you.
Briefly, synopsis of the NCAA wrestling championships. Iowa State and Iowa both finished down the standings in team scoring. In fact, Iowa State finished fourth with 68.5 points. Iowa finished fifth with 67 points. Penn State, again, ran away with it with 172 points, 100 points ahead of second-place Cornell. But outstanding wrestlers David Carr of Iowa State was a champion in the 165-pound class. And Northern Iowa's Parker Kekeisen finished an undefeated 31-0 season to win the championship at 184 pounds. Here's an article about the Iowa State men's college basketball team, who won again last night or yesterday. Iowa State must play strong for 40 minutes from here on out, by Randy Peterson. Iowa State's been playing so well, especially since the start of the Big 12 tournament championship run, that maybe one of the worst scoring halves this season was to be expected. Well, maybe. Or, as Rob Jones said, indifferent. Having the kind of half like that shows me everybody's going out to get us, Jones said in the locker room after the game. We've seen that kind of play from opponents for a long time, especially recently. Yeah, The Cyclones shot just 31% in the first half, forced just 3 turnovers in the first 20 minutes, and as poor as the offense was, the halftime score in the round of 32 game against Washington State was just 27-all. The offense isn't there sometimes, but we've always got our defense, Curtis Jones said. After the fourth-ranked Cyclones' 67-56 victory against Washington State put them in next week's Sweet 16 in Boston. Iowa State will play Illinois in the East Regional semifinal. We came out slow, but we turned it on in the second half, Jones continued. Why were we able to turn it on? Defense, man. No kidding. More about that later. This wasn't anything like the start of the South Dakota State game, during which the Cyclones made their first 9 shots. This time they missed their first 10. And they were still in the game at the break. That's a bunch of defense leading to points and better shooting. When did sophomore star Taman Lipsey know Iowa State was going to win? Probably Milan's, that's Miksilovic, 3-pointer, Lipsey said, after the shot with 2:50 left in the game that put Iowa State up by 12. We had good momentum going. We kept being aggressive. We had that lead. Switching now to women's basketball. Beating West Virginia's press is the key for Iowa to reach the Sweet 16. The last 2 years of the second-round NCAA tournament games in Carver-Hawkeye Arena have produced extremely challenging circumstances for the Iowa women's basketball team. On the surface, a third in a row should be expected in Caitlin Clark's final college home game. Eighth-seeded West Virginia, with a record of 25-7, brings a confident mentality and ball-hawking defense into Monday's 7 p.m. ESPN televised matchup against Iowa, whose record is 30-4, with a berth in the NCAA tournament's Sweet 16 on the line. Virginia's Lauren Fields said, "We just all have fun on the defensive end. It's something we like to do. We feed off each other when we're getting steals." Iowa is the top seed in the Albany 2 region and would face fifth-seeded Colorado next Saturday with a win. But the Hawkeyes are likely to be without Molly Davis, their second-best ball handler, for the fifth straight game after she injured her right knee against Ohio State on March 3rd. That could prove to be a notable absence. Sydney Afolter has done a terrific job handling Davis' starting role, but she's more like a small forward. It puts more responsibility on Clark's shoulders to handle West Virginia's constant full-court pressure defense. If Molly can't go, we've just got to hope that everybody keeps composed and doesn't get into foul trouble, Iowa Associate Head Coach Jan Jensen said, referring in part to Clark showing ample frustration in Saturday's 91-65 opening win against Holy Cross. I think Caitlin's up for the challenge. She's got a lot of pressure. She'll admit that on Saturday was not a great night for that. Clark knows that West Virginia's press will be Iowa's biggest challenge on Monday. That's a summary of the sports for today. Here's Carol now with Dear Abby.
Thank you, Jeff. Dear Abby, I am 34 and recently found out I've started menopause. I knew it might come early for me because most of the women in my family began in their 30s and were done by 50. I have no biological children and now probably never will. I guess I waited too long for the right time, the right person, etc. I was always careful to use birth control when I became sexually active and never left it up to my partner. I am now having a hard time coping with this feeling of loss. I know I shouldn't be grieving something I never had, but I found myself tearing up thinking about it. I'm angry at myself for missing out on it. I've been married to a wonderful man for almost 2 years, but we have been together for 10 years. I wanted to be married and financially stable before having children. I feel like I'm being punished. My poor husband takes the brunt of my frustrations and anger, which isn't fair, and I apologize when it happens, but I find myself slowly drifting into isolation because of it. I don't know what to do anymore. I'm sad, angry, frustrated, and empty. I wish I had an answer or anyone who understands to just hear me. Signed, Grieving in Oregon. And Abby says, Dear Grieving, your feelings are understandable. It's time to seek counseling for help, to stop blaming yourself or your husband and cope with your feelings of sadness, anger, and frustration. Once that is done, it may be time to consider your options for fulfilling your maternal instincts. These include fostering, adoption, surrogacy, and volunteer mentoring. Please consider them. And a second letter. Dear Abby, 3 years ago I discovered I was being excluded by my coworkers. I have tried to not let it bother me, but it's starting to wear me down emotionally. I work in a dental office with a staff of 7 women. I have worked with 2 of them for almost 20 years, and I always thought we had a friendship because we would go to lunch together and occasionally do things outside of work. 3 years ago, I learned they have a group chat with 2 of the other women and have gotten together outside of work and did not include me. What bothers me most is they laugh and talk in front of me about the funny memes and videos they send each other. I am tired of being excluded, and I don't understand why they've done it. We all get along, so I'm not sure why this is happening. Any advice on what I should say or do? Signed, Apart in Illinois. Abby says, Dear Apart, folks are entitled to socialize, or not, with anyone they would like after work. However, to treat you the way they have seems insensitive, bordering on rude, and you have every right to say so the next time it happens. It may lead to a difficult discussion, but you have a right to tell them how it affects you. Do not depend upon your coworkers to be personal friends, which may not be possible. I encourage you to cultivate social relationships outside the office from now on. Jeff?
Well, that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, Monday, March 25th, 2024. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockard. Earlier, you heard from Nicole Tam and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.